Having arrived, we'll call to order the Finance Committee meeting of Monday, August 25th, 2025, and ask Dave to please call the roll.
Council President Vittiver?
Here.
Alder Verveer?
Here.
Alder Govindarajan?
Alder Govindarajan is going to be 5 minutes late.
Alder Madison?
Here.
Alder Evers?
Here.
Alder Figueroa Cole?
Here.
Mayor of Quorum.
Thank you. All right. We have public comment on specific items, but no general public comment. So we'll move to disclosures and recusals. Are there any disclosures or recusals on items on today's agenda? Alder Verveer?
Thank you, Mayor. As it relates to agenda item number 8, I disclose that I am a non-voting ex officio member of the Downtown Madison Incorporated Board of Directors. As you can see from my sponsorship of the resolution, however, I do not believe that that disqualifies me under the City Ethics Code. Thank you.
Thank you, Alder. Are there any other disclosures or recusals on today's agenda? Right. And we'll move on to the consent agenda. We have registrants wishing to speak on item 2. And items 15 and 16 are discussion items, so those will be separated from the consent agenda. Are there other items that members of the body would like to see excluded from the consent agenda? President Vittiver?
Item 5.
Item 5. Are there any other items that members of the body would like to have excluded from the consent agenda at this time? Okay, so if not, then we'll be excluding items 2, 5, 15, and 16. President Vittiver, can I have a motion on the balance of the agenda?
Move to adopt.
Is there a second? Anyone?
Second.
Thank you. Moved and seconded to adopt the consent agenda items and the recommendations therein. Again, exclusions are 2, 5, 15, and 16. On the consent agenda, is there any objection to recording a unanimous vote in favor? Seeing no objection, we'll record a unanimous vote in favor of the consent agenda and the recommendations therein. And we will move on to item 2. Item 2 is Legistar 89254, amending sections of the Madison General Ordinances, amending and creating sections of the Madison General Ordinances to enhance the city's street tree protection provisions and establish a street tree replacement fund. On item 2, we have two registrants wishing to speak. Our first registrant is Robert Proctor of District 4, representing the Realtors Association of South Central Wisconsin, to be followed by Carol Schaefer. Robert?
Good afternoon, Mayor. I was a little disappointed that you didn't move this meeting to an outside meeting, since it's so beautiful outside and we could have actually looked at the trees. But again, thank you for giving me the opportunity to share the realtor's perspective. First, I want to be clear that protecting street trees is something we all support. The value they add to our neighborhoods and our quality of life is obvious. Our concern is not with the goal, but with making sure the ordinance itself is clear and practical. And we, as you've seen in our written comments, we agree with smart growth comments and think that they're very limited clarifications. We understand that the city forester, from his testimony, that this ordinance is not intended to extend onto private property. That intent makes sense and we agree with it, but as written, the language could be read differently. We think it's important to make crystal clear that the tree protection zone ends at the property line. That way we avoid confusion or unintended creation of a new kind of construction setback on private property. We also want to just raise a practical point. Some of our most ambitious construction projects, Those that bring in the greatest investment into our city require use of the street for cranes and staging. If a right-of-way permit can be suspended or revoked in a way that stops work, it could force a contractor to demobilize a site, take down a tower crane, or halt the entire project until a new right-of-way permit is issued. That's not just costly, but could be crippling. I think of so many of these whether it's the city doing its own work or an owner that you see come in. The owners hire people like Findorf, Cullen, Stevens. And I saw the pictures that were sent in with the comments, I believe, from the city's forester. And you look at those two trees that they show and you say, okay, could you really have a forester just revoke a right-of-way license, a right-of-way permit, and require that the contractor demobilize the entire site and remove everything from the right-of-way because the contractor or this contractor subcontractor did a poor job in setting up the site or didn't live up to the expectations? So in that case, what we're looking for is just clarification so that if there is a violation, that the owner can quickly get out of the suspension by making sure that the project comes into compliance. So again, we want the forester to have the tools to protect the trees, but we also want there to be a reflection that losing 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month and a half, trying to go through an appeal process regarding a revocation or a suspension could be crippling to a very large project. So at this point, to be clear, we want owners and contractors to diligently follow the law, but the penalties need to be proportional. That's why we think a clarification is consistent with both the intent of the ordinance and the city forester's vision. In short, protect the trees, but do it with language that's clear, practical, and proportional in its enforcement. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next registrant is Carol Schaefer of West Maine, representing Smart Growth Greater Madison. Carol?
Thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak here. And if I could just say ditto to what Robert said, I don't want to repeat all of that, but I agree with everything that he just spoke about in terms of having clarification and making, particularly when it comes to the revocation, that is something that could be particularly egregious and have having to completely deconstruct a site and stop a project in mid-process could be hugely problematic. And so we're very concerned about that. And so getting clarification on that and having a quick way to rectify a situation would be great. We were a little disappointed that the industry was not included in any of the conversations about this as it was being drafted, because we too, I mean, I live close to downtown, absolutely love my tree-lined street. We support greatly the mission of supporting our urban forest, but also want to be able to do it in a way that doesn't put an undue punishment on a mistake that could happen. So how do we have that clarification? And we do recognize that, in this being the finance committee, that there is this will add additional costs to projects, having to have the arborist and having to do just have anytime you add process and more requirements that add costs, it hits the bottom line. So just as we're aware of that. And so I guess our ask is that there would be a motion asking the Common Council to re-refer this so that we could have further conversation and maybe work out some language that meets the goals of the tree preservation and protection while also minimizing the potential negative consequences. So hopefully we could have a collaboration and come up with something that is a win for the trees, but doesn't unduly punish projects. Thanks.
Thank you. Are there questions for either of the registrants? President Vinover?
Yeah, just I'm a little confused. I want to make sure that we're all looking at the right thing. So when I'm looking at Legistar, is what is under consideration the ordinance changes 7-22-25 draft? And if so, the question for the registrants is, have those changes addressed the issues that you're concerned about, or are there still additional issues that need to be addressed?
So, Robert, and then Carol, just to clarify for the public and anybody who isn't in the Legistar weeds of this, My understanding is that Alder Field intends to offer some amendments at Plan Commission, which I believe is what is reflected in Legistar. So I think just as a process note, probably better to let Plan Commission address that than this body. But yes, I think intention to make some of the clarification changes that have been asked for via email. So I'm not sure, but I since this is a question, I will give Robert and Carol a chance to respond to the Alder's question of, are you asking for additional changes than what is anticipated to be introduced at Plan Commission tonight?
I'm looking to make sure that I have the most up-to-date one. The one that I read this morning did not make clear that the protection zone was only within the right-of-way. And when I watched the forester's testimony, he said that he just assumed that as that that's just a matter of, these are my words, but I took his testimony that he says, yeah, our jurisdiction's only within the right-of-way. I don't believe that's true as a legal matter. I believe as written, it would, if you say 20 feet around the tree, it would go onto private property. There's lots of ordinances that deal with trees on private property. So I don't believe I saw anything that limited this to within the right-of-way. And then the second point regarding the ability for the forester to simply revoke a right-of-way permit without any process to address the issue, I don't believe for a second that the forester intends to, for a minor violation, to stop a major project. But that's why I would say that having some basic level of process, like for the pictures that they show, that, you know, if you issue a stop work order and put in, you know, here's why, and if you cure those things, you can, you know, the suspension will be lifted. That's all we're looking for, and I don't see that in there either. Those were the two biggest things that I saw, and I don't see that in the updated one, but I could be missing it. Thank you.
Thank you. And Carol, did you have any additional things?
I would just add to that, my understanding is that the revocation piece had not been addressed in any anticipated amendments, but without seeing, I hadn't gotten a copy of the specific language, but that was my understanding that that had not been addressed. And so we still have that as a concern. And again, I would echo what Robert said, that I don't believe that it's intended to be misused, but as long as it's there without clarification, without resolution, it can be daunting.
Thank you. Alder, President Ritter, any additional questions? Alder Evers?
Thank you, Mayor. I believe you're correct that the current version that's in Legistar does not yet have the changes that are being proposed by Alder Field. And those are, so what we're looking at now is not the version that likely will be voted on tonight at Plan Commission and will be then on the agenda on September 2nd for Common Council. That's my understanding as well.
Thank you, Alder. Did you have any questions? No.
I did not. I was just offering that clarification. Thanks.
Thank you. Any additional questions for the registrants? If not, then what's before us is item two. A motion, please, on item two.
Move to adopt.
Second.
Moved and seconded to adopt item two. Again, with the understanding that likely what will be before council is a substitute. Are there questions for staff on item two? Seeing none. Alder Figueroa Cole.
Thank you, Mayor. So I do have, I did raise some issues at Plan Commission on this particular item, but since we're in finance, I guess I'm trying to understand what exactly are we approving the policy? Are we approving the fee policy? What exactly is it that this committee has purview over for this particular request?
So we see the whole item because it has potentially fiscal implications. But generally, yes, you would look more at the fiscal items than the other items and potentially defer to other committees on the things that would be more in their purview. But we're voting on the whole thing.
So I do have a quick question in regards to all the different language about the fees. Do we have are those fees available on a different format, like in a table or something that are easier to consume? Because it's, I don't know. That's the question number one. Do we have an easier way to present the fees on a table format that we understand these fees for this reason, this one is for the other reason? That's question one. And if you...
So, other is that's more of a presentation question. Do you mean, like, if, assuming this ordinance passes, in terms of how we communicate it to the public?
I mean, like, how to communicate to any of us? Like, just do we have, is that already existing? We have a table that can be shared with us or not?
I'll defer to Superintendent Reminds, but I don't think so.
No, currently we don't have a table that outlines the fees. There's not really a significant impact of fees. There's a little bit if a tree needs to be removed, but that's really not the main point of the ordinance. But certainly, I understand what you're getting at. You have to read through a lot of text to see kind of what's there. Certainly, point taken.
Mm-hmm. And then also then on that language, depending on what you're talking about on the different clauses, the language is repetitive, but then some areas is more specific than the others. And the one that I'm trying to still get my head around is something that reads the cost associated with removing the tree, including wood disposal. So do we have is that going to be something that is going to be constantly changing? Are we going to have fixed fees, or are we going to have a scale of fees? How is that? Like, I'm still, from all that wording, it's still unclear to me how much it's going to cost me. As you know, if I was a developer, how much it's going to cost to repay a tree that got removed?
So what we have currently is a fee structure that is approved, I believe it's every year, that is based on our costs to remove and replant a tree. And that's typically, I will say, what we typically use is the cost that gets approved for new plats for planting trees there, and then our cost to actually remove the tree. So that is something we have readily available, and it gets updated every year. But it's not, you don't find that in ordinance, because otherwise we'd have to update the ordinance every year when we're updating our fee, our costs of doing that work. But that is something we have readily available if you'd like that, or if a developer would want that. Our costs are bluntly pretty low, because we're very efficient at removing and replanting trees. It's a core part of what we do. So really what we found is it's not a deterrent at all to preventing trees from being removed.
Okay. And then the last question is, like, how the only thing that's unclear for me on the policy is what criteria is used to determine the value of the tree? Is it a 100-year tree? Are we determine the value based on the life left, or are we determine the value on the potential life that is left on the tree? What is that? Still also unclear for me.
So, and the name of it, of the actual guide, Alder, is escaping me. I can certainly get that for you. Ian knows it on the tip of his tongue. But there is a guide out there that values trees that takes into the criteria exactly as you're suggesting, the species, the condition, all of those factors, and then also makes allowance for that is a tree being grown in a right-of-way versus, say, an open field. So that data exists. It's not something that's being pulled out of the air by staff.
Yeah, so thank you for that. I appreciate that. It's just like the way that the ordinance is written to me, if I were to be, you know, like, expected to respond to this ordinance. I would like to understand like how, like the whole picture, what the dollar amount is, and sure. The way that it's written, I don't. It's a little bit hard for me to follow. Like you said, some of the information is not public, so I have concerns about that.
It is something that our forestry specialists are aware of, and something that's discussed during project development phases, and when they start working with developers and contractors, when that becomes a relevant piece of the conversation. So they know it well and are able to discuss in specificity with developers and their contractors on what a cost might be to remove a tree.
Thank you. And also, it's my understanding that this discussion has been happening today simultaneously in three different committees.
We have Ian is at Plan Commission, where I'm going after this is over, and then Craig Klinke is at who's number two in forestry, is at the Sustainability Committee, and he's handling it there. Yes, that's correct.
So, and who is then the lead for whose decision or recommendations will land on the Aldis agenda? Who's the lead on this?
Well, ultimately, this feeds up through the Board of Public Works to Council.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you, Alder. Are there other questions for staff? Alder Vivier?
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you, Superintendent Romines, for being here and for all your work on this proposal. Let me just begin for a point of information about the timeline. As I know it, as Charlie, you just stated, Board of Public Works is the lead committee because they have jurisdiction now over our street trees, with your division taking over that function. And that BPW meeting is September 3rd. So I just want to clarify for all those listening that this is scheduled to go to the council meeting of September 16th, as opposed to the next council meeting. But anyway, my question, Charlie, is as to the issue of what's the real jurisdiction of the Finance Committee. The one area that it seems to me that hasn't been mentioned yet in this venue is establishing a street tree replacement fund. So could you just take a moment and explain to everyone what that street tree replacement fund would be and why it's being proposed?
Sure, thank you for asking. So what we're looking to do there, the purpose is really twofold. Probably the secondary purpose is we get contacted from time to time with people looking to make donations to the urban forest. And we really don't have a good way to accept those. And so oftentimes it's when they're doing estate planning or something of that nature, or perhaps they're leaving town and want to make something, some legacy behind. So there's that. But the primary reason for it is it gives the city forester another way to work with the developers when I'll say trouble arises, right? So sometimes a tree, even one that was intended to be saved, has to come down because of some development in the project. And we run into instances where there's really no way to mitigate that on that property. When there is, usually that's worked out very quickly. There's an agreement made, and it may be that the developer is going to plant two additional trees in the right of way, kind of on their kind of section of the right of way, and off we go. But in certain times, it's not possible. And so what we're looking to do there with the creation of this fund is where that's not possible, and the developer would like to just essentially write a check to cover the cost that's agreed upon for what the mitigation is or the remediation is for the trees that have had to be removed. This fund allows them to do that and then funds forestry to do that work. So what that might look like is a tree comes down because they're putting in a driveway or they had to move the driveway. And so there's no other place on that stretch of frontage that is adjacent to the development to plant a tree. And so this would give that developer and the city forest an opportunity to say, hey, here's the cost to plant a tree or a couple of trees, whatever the agreement would be, you know, around the corner or across the street or wherever, where we have some sites that would make sense and would allow the developer to fund that, thus satisfy the urban forest's interests. And in that case, what you would have is a situation where that could be done very quickly, like in a day. And there would be no revocation of any permits or anything of that nature. So it's really providing another kind of outlet for when there's no way to, you know, mitigate or remediate what happened during the project build to that tree within that adjacent right-of-way.
Thank you for the explanation. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Alder. Are there any other questions for staff on item two? If not, thank you, Charlie. Then item two has been moved and seconded. Is there discussion? Seeing, nope. Alder Figueroa Cole.
Well, doesn't matter. I will be watching the Plan Commission meeting either after this or later when it's recorded, and we'll follow these policy to the other committees before I make my determination. So can you please count me as a no at this moment? Or as abstain or whatever, I don't care, whichever. Just to say no, because I don't abstaining. At this moment, I just still need to get more information from other angles. Thank you.
Thank you, Alder. Alder Uguerra?
Thank you, Mayor. Just for information purposes, I think we will see action at the Plan Commission. I'm a commissioner. That will be proposing a substitute that clarifies some of the language you heard about or described by our registrants, possibly some additional ones from the commissioners. I would hope that we could have that Second Amendment drafting ready in time so that it could be considered when the Board of Public Works, which has the leads, can look at it next week. Thank you.
Thank you, Alder. Is there any other discussion from the body? Seeing none, is there any objection if I speak from the chair? Seeing no objection, I'm one of the sponsors of this, and I think that there has been a lot of confusion and possibly misinformation about both the intent and I think the impact of this ordinance. The first thing that I think is potentially confusing is that we are not talking about all street trees. We are talking about the street trees that in the course of approving a development project, the city and the developer agree are worth saving. And this, so this doesn't, for example, interact with the complete streets, complete green streets policy at all, because this is only in effect when the developer and the city have agreed that an existing tree is worth saving. So that's the realm of discussion here. And what we have seen over years, if not decades, is that all too often, even when the city and the developer agree that a tree is worth saving, that the developer doesn't respect that and doesn't take the necessary actions to actually protect and save that tree. And I think that is in part because the consequences of not protecting and saving that tree are incredibly small at this point in time. So this is really just an effort to say, no, you have to take this seriously. If we are agreeing between us that this is a tree worth saving, then you have to do that. And if you don't do that, there are consequences that are meaningful. Now, it's been brought up, people make mistakes. Something might happen. We might hurt a tree, even with the best of intentions, even with the best protections, even with the widest fences, something might happen. Yes, of course, things happen. In that case, the next thing that happens is that the developer goes to forestry and says, how can we make this right? And
if they can agree on a how can we make this right, which you just heard that Charlotte, Superintendent Romine say, that might be that they plant extra trees in the right of way next to their project, or it might be that they make a contribution to the tree protection fund, right? So there are options to solve it almost immediately. If it is not solved almost immediately, then yes, perhaps a permit, not the whole permit for the whole project, but just a permit with respect to the right-of-way, could be held, in which case it would go to the next Board of Public Works meeting for their review. Board of Public Works meets every 2 weeks. We're not talking about a long time that a project might have to wait. It would not have to stop work. It might have to stop work around that tree, but it would not have to stop the overall project. So I think, you know, we're actually talking about a pretty unlikely circumstance that a whole project would be impacted by a mistake. Now, if a developer is, you know, flagrantly violating the ordinances and just taking trees down willy-nilly, I think we'd probably want to stop that project no matter what. So, this is really only in the case of the worst actors that the worst consequences would come into play. All that said, as one of the sponsors, we have been talking about language that would clarify the intent and the impact, and that is not problematic at all. And in fact, we are just waiting for the committees tonight to draft a substitute. Obviously want to see what happens at Plan Commission, what they're asking for, so that we can make sure that substitute will be comprehensive, and expect that substitute to go to the Board of Public Works and then presumably come to council. So I think that this is, trying to think of an appropriate tree-related metaphor, but I'm not coming up with one. I think that this is not really that big a deal. I think there are some easy changes to language to tighten up and clarify the intent. But I also think that, you know, at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is a really important thing, and that is that when everyone is in agreement that a tree is worth saving, that we actually save it. And it's really just about bringing stronger consequences when somebody does not take seriously their commitment to protect a tree. So I would hope that you would all be supportive of this, both tonight at the various other committees, and then when it does finally come to us at council. Thank you for letting me speak from the chair. Is there any further discussion? Alder Verveer.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mayor. I really appreciate your explanation of why several of us are supporting this ordinance. I don't want to add to much to what you said. You said it very well. I simply want to share with my colleagues that if you have not dealt with the loss of a street tree due to construction, you're very lucky. I have dealt with far too many of these incidents that have occurred over the years. And most recently, we saw what will likely be the removal of a city street tree only a half block from my home last week due to construction accident. In fact, the question and answer document that the street superintendent shared with us this afternoon depicts three photos of that construction site on West Main Street. And if you look at the third photo, you'll see that there was a significant loss of a limb due to contractor error. But the other pictures in that Q&A are more telling, because you see the inadequacy of the existing tree protection zone under our decade-old ordinance, and you see the repeated violations of that ordinance. So, I couldn't agree more again, Mayor, with your sentiments, and I urge my colleagues to support this. We are certainly, as sponsors, are working on the clarifications that the industry is seeking. There was a meeting this morning with the appropriate city staff thoroughly reviewing the recommendations of Smart Growth. and the drafting attorney and other staff are looking at all aspects of what clarifications might be needed. So I know there'll be a thorough vetting of this yet within the hour or two at Plan Commission. And I know that that will be the case moving forward. So I have every expectation that there will be some sort of substitute that the sponsors can agree to in the next couple of weeks before this comes to the council. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alder. Alder Evers?
Thank you, Mayor. I want to join Alder Verbeer in expressing my appreciation to you, Mayor, and summarizing the salient issues. I, too, am faced with a situation where a private landowner wanting to build his dream home came up with plans that were very close to a very large canopy tree. And I think was sorely tempted to perhaps go ahead and take the tree down and pay the rather modest fine. We were able to prevail upon this individual not to do so, but I think what the mayor is suggesting, if I might be so bold as to try to summarize her summary, is that we need to change the incentive structure so that people take seriously our shared community values on our street canopy trees, the street trees, so that the social cost of not caring for them and unduly or taking risks that would damage the trees or cause the loss of trees or even intentionally take one down and just pay the fine, that the social environmental costs would be included in the decision making that a developer or a private landowner does, that they cannot be willy-nilly externalized and put on the rest of us. One of the registrants spoke and said, of course, this will increase the cost to developers. Well, when we changed our stormwater ordinance, we heard the same complaints. But when we internalized some of these social and environmental costs, yes, these are costs that are already taking place. When we lose these values, that's a loss to the community that might be hard to monetize. But we have to somehow or another include those costs in our decision-making process if we're going to retain the value of the street trees that we all share. Thank you.
Thank you, Alder. Is there any, Alder, are you there?
I just want to also endorse the summary that you provided, Mayor, and just point out that I thought that your description of how it should work when there's a problem with restoring or maintaining some trees that were by agreement to be preserved. We just had that example here within the last 2 weeks, one of my favorite projects. You all know which one that is. But in that case, there was an agreement to preserve several trees that were very nice. But as the developer worked out the exact siting with the city of the placement of the new sidewalk, it became clear that the construction for the sidewalk was very likely to permanently damage those trees. The developer immediately got together with the city forester, determined that, yes, there was an agreement that it probably would cause the ultimate death of those trees, but they resolved it by agreeing on additional plantings of trees in the terrace at the completion of the project. That's the way it should happen. It all happened before there was any need to consider a penalty under this new ordinance. And I think, and I would hope here in the next hour at Plan Commission that we'll also appreciate that that's the way it should work and the penalties need to be there to accomplish what we're trying to accomplish. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Alder. Is there any additional discussion on item two? Seeing none. Then item two has been moved and seconded. With the exception of Alder Figueroa Cole, is there any objection to recording a vote in favor? Seeing no objection, then we'll record that vote and note Alder Figueroa Cole is voting no. And that will bring us to item five, which is Legistar 89324, authorizing the mayor and clerk to execute an amendment
to the Bree Stevens Stadium Use and Operating Agreement with Big Top Events, LLC, to update the limitations on alcohol sales at stadium events. And on item five, we do have one registrant as available for questions. That's Connor Kaloya of District 6 in support and available to answer questions. Are there any questions for the registrant? President Vidover?
Is the registrant from Big Top?
Yes.
Okay, great. That's who I have a question for. The question is very simple, and that is are there THC-containing beverages being sold at Bree Stevens?
Connor?
Thanks, Mayor, and thanks, Council President, for the question. We currently do not sell those beverages, and at this time do not have any plans to do so. We have candidly have found the insurance, the proper insurance to be properly covered, too burdensome to sell those products. So not something we're currently doing and not something I can tell you that we have any future plans on at this time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, President Vidover. Any additional questions for the registrant? If not, thank you, Connor. And then on item five, can I get a motion, please?
Move to adopt.
Second.
All right, moved and seconded to adopt item five. Are there any questions for staff on item five? Seeing no questions for staff, is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, is there any objection to recording unanimous vote in favor of item five? Seeing no objection, we'll record that vote on item five. And that will take us to item 15, which is Legistar 89653, an overview of the 2026 operating budget requests and budget process. And I will turn it over to Christine.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. I sent in a presentation to Alders and it's attached to Legistar, but I will be going through an overview of the operating requests and talk more generally about the process and legislative timeline coming up. So first, I'll take a step back, talk through the general calendar and how we develop the operating budget assumptions and cost to continue. Have a few highlights on agency requests, and then again talk about the legislative timeline, including the upcoming capital briefings, which will occur during the next Finance Committee meetings. So just as a reminder, or, you know, we've talked about cost to continue as a concept with the Finance Committee, but every year's budget begins with reviewing the current year budget as the baseline and then making adjustments for primarily for salaries and benefits that we apply to all city positions, as well as factoring in contractual increases and other adjustments as appropriate. When we get to the request phase with agencies, cost to continue sets a target for agencies. And then when we get to request, the agency requests reflect both these cost to continue changes that they don't necessarily calculate themselves, but are kind of baked into their baseline. And it reflects what the agency asks for in terms of reallocating the budget within their base or including supplemental requests. And in general, the general fund agencies were given a target and stuck to that target when submitting their request to the mayor. And agency and enterprise agencies have a little more flexibility of proposing a budget based on projected revenues. After the requests are submitted, we in the finance department do a round of technical adjustments. This is where we're updating final benefit rates, debt service, and making some other corrections of things that we might have missed earlier, adjusting interdepartmental charges and things like that, and working closely with the mayor's office to develop an executive budget. The mayor's budget is always balanced and is proposed to the Common Council for consideration. So there are many points of change throughout the budget request process. When we first presented the cost to continue, we came to the Finance Committee in June 23rd, So we do have a full presentation attached to file 88414, and you can also go back to that meeting recording to watch a more in-depth presentation on our cost to continue assumptions. But at that time, we projected a budget gap of about $6.2 million, which was in line with the projections we presented in our five-year operating plan for the adopted budget. We knew that the structural gap would reopen, and we presented a plan to cover that through a mix of fund balance and other adjustments. So again, going back to June, our expenditures were projected at around $456 million. That's about $24 million than our current 25 adopted budget, or 5.5% higher. The largest portion of this change is related to salary and benefit adjustments. This is assuming a 3% COLA for GMEs and increases to health insurance, WRS, and fringe benefits, and a $6.5 million increase to the Metro subsidy, a $6.2 million placeholder increase for debt service. There were various changes to non-personnel costs, primarily in purchase services, but these costs net to zero. The biggest increases were funding for software, primarily in IT, but in other agencies as well, that totaled about $1.3 million. An increase in library costs for shared services based on the Dane County formula for shared services and various revenue adjustments. And other increases that were offset by removing $2 million in one-time funding in CDD that were supporting homeless services that were funded through some ARPA reallocations that happened at the end of 2024. And the totals above for staffing and services include the cost of two additional elections in the clerk's office. This fluctuation is really reflecting the gubernatorial election in 2026 and administering four elections instead of two. It doesn't reflect a general change in service levels in the clerk. On the revenue side, the projection had revenues at $450.1 million. This was $17.6 million, or 4.1% higher than our current adopted budget, the largest portion being about a $14 million increase in the levy, a $3 million increase in interest earnings, a small $500,000 reduction in building permit revenues, and removing about $800,000 in one-time fund balance for unsheltered operations, again, related to various ARPA changes. So the next two slides have a breakdown of each of these categories in more detail. Again, I'm not going to read through this because we've talked about this in depth, and I'm happy to take any questions at the end, but this is explaining a little bit more about our assumptions around what the benefit rate increases would be, et cetera. So here we have a more detailed summary of the cost to continue adjustment expenses, as well as other adjustments for the general fund subsidies to Metro, public health, and our changes to interdepartmental billings and charges. These are primarily generated through our fleet rate, cost allocation, which is how we charge the cost of indirect support provided by central service agencies to enterprises, like the cost of HR, finance, and administrative functions that benefit enterprises, as well as billings and charges for insurance and workers' comp. The June presentation also provided more context on Metro Transit's operating revenues. One of the large cost to continue adjustments is increasing the Metro subsidy by a little over $6 million for a total of $25 million in 2026. So this graph provides a snapshot of Metro's revenues. So you can see the primary sources. The dark teal section in the bottom represents the city subsidy. So prior to the pandemic, the subsidy was at about $15 million annually. The subsidy went to zero in 2020, was slightly restored in 21 and 22, and was reduced in 23. And these reductions were related to drawing down federal COVID relief money. The corresponding federal funds is in this purple color, and you can see large influxes in 2020 and 2023 related to the interaction with the city subsidy being decreased. So those are the areas where you do see fluctuations year over year. And in many of the other funding sources within Metro, such as state revenues or the vehicle registration fees, those rates are pretty steady year over year. So as we were building out the 26 budget, we assumed kind of steady levels of funding from other sources and increase the general fund subsidy to help Metro submit a balanced budget. Now I want to really quickly go through how to read through the agency requests that are all posted on our city website. So if you go to cityofmadison.com/budget, you can see all of the budget years and phases. If you click on 26 operating, you'll have a copy of the agency requests as well as the mayor's guidance. And you can open up any of the agency files or review the whole packet. So for example, if you were to open up finance, every agency has a cover page that summarizes the request. Oh, you are not seeing my screen. Sorry about that. Okay, that should be better. All right, so the city's website, again, you can go through all of the budget phases and then you can click on any of the agencies. Every agency will start with a summary page. This was prepared by the finance department that shows the budget in a few different tables. We have the total request by fund, by service, and then by major revenue and expense category. And it shows different phases from the 23 actuals through the 26 requests. So you're able to compare a little bit of the differences across phases. That's usually one page. And then there is the agency's memo to the mayor as part of their budget request, where they're highlighting any of the changes in their request. And then you'll see a series of forms where the agency submitted any changes to their budget by service. So these are the categories that we organize the budget by. Finance, we have accounting, budget, risk management, et cetera. Going back to the slides. So this is just a snapshot of one of the tables where you can compare what's happening in the budget by phase. So I condensed this a little bit, but here we have finance by the major expenditure categories. We have the 25 adopted budget, 26 cost to continue, and the 26 request. So the first two lines are always salaries and benefits. If you see changes across phases here, this is almost certainly going to be related to the centrally calculated adjustments for steps on longevity, COLAs, higher WRS fringe benefits. Then we typically have our non-personnel lines for supplies and purchase services. If you see increase here, these are typically cost to continue adjustments for things like multi-year contracts, higher utility bills, or other costs where, you know, we can see based on trends or agreements that there needs to be an adjustment in the upcoming year. And then the last section is usually our interdepartmental charges and billings. And most of these are centrally calculated for things like insurance, workers' comp, fleet. And you actually might see some large variances from year over year. We have allocation formulas that look at, you know, the average of the past 3 years. So there might be situations where it's a small dollar amount, but a large percentage change based on how the formulas are calculated. So that's kind of what all of the rows represent. And then if you're comparing 25 adopted to 26 cost to continue, again, these are primarily our standard adjustments that are centrally calculated by the finance department. The cost to continue number is the target number that agencies receive to build their base budget request on. And then you can notice in this finance example, cost to continue and request is the same amount because we stayed within our budget target. You might have some agencies might have some reallocations across lines, but generally general fund agencies stuck to their target number. And the totals do not include the supplemental requests that were a separate form. And then I mentioned that we do go through a series of technical adjustments and corrections, and this is just based on the timing of when we receive information. So we receive final benefit rates mid to late summer, and our assumptions for health insurance and WRS rates were higher than what the actual rates came in at. So this actually generated a bit of savings compared to cost to continue. You will not see this yet in the request documents because we actually got those numbers after agencies submitted requests. But there were various adjustments to our benefit rates. There was a savings in duty disability premiums for police and fire and some other adjustments that we made. So right now our benefits number is 2.6 million less than the total presented in request. There are also a few things that we missed in cost to continue. There are always a handful of items like that each year. The clerk's office didn't have the full software expense for Blue Crest, so we added that into our budget software. We made a correction to our cost allocation billings that added about $144,000 to the general fund. There are some changes to direct appropriations for revenue sharing payments. There was an increase in police to reflect the general fund contribution to the COPS grant. Those officers, that grant is ending, and those officers will be fully on the city levy at the end of next year. So we needed to make that adjustment. And in streets, we had to correct a salary savings number that we had overestimated. So with the savings from benefits rates and the costs that we had missed, the net savings from these adjustments is 1.9 million in savings. So that's our expenditures are less than what we had projected when we started the cost to continue process. So one other aspect of requests that I mentioned was we allowed agencies to submit supplemental requests in specific circumstances. If there was a new city facility that required operational funding in the upcoming year, or if there was a situation where one-time funding was ending and if there was a request to convert that to add general fund money to replace that one-time money. And this is mostly in the situation of grants that were ending. This table summarizes all of the official supplemental requests that were submitted, and you can read the detail entry form for each of these within the agency budgets. For CDD, there was a request to add funding for the permanent men's shelter operations. Economic Development had a request to fund the Kiva Madison program that was previously in capital in the operating budget. HR had some position changes related to a new software and realigning services provided with Metro. Library had a request for funding operations at the Imagination Center at Rindle Park. Mayor's office had a request related to the grant funds ending and moving costs to the general fund. Parks had two requests, one also related to the Imagination Center at Rindle Park and one for a facility position at Warner Park Community Center with that facility expansion, and streets had a request related to Olin drop-off sites. In total, all of these requests in 2026 would add about 1.8 million in 26, and the annualized cost is about 3.4 million. And these costs are higher because several of these positions would be mid or late year starts. So the annualized cost picks up a full year of operations after 2026. One thing to note is that some agencies noted additional requests in their memos, but didn't submit a supplemental form. So in enterprise funds, they were allowed to add expenses if they had projected revenues to meet those expenses. So there might be things that were adjusted within an enterprise fund that did not have a full supplemental attached. The fire memo noted a request for an additional ambulance, and OIM noted a request related to restoring funding levels. So there is some additional detail if you read into the agency memos, but the major items are listed in the table on the slide. Right. I think one more slide about operating requests. And we've talked a bit with the Finance Committee about the Expenditure Restraint Incentive Program. The city qualifies for $7 million in state aid if it keeps the increase, the year-over-year increase in the general fund budget, excluding debt service, below the change in the CPI plus 60% of net new construction. So in 2026, the estimated growth limit an expenditure restraint is a 4% increase. Cost to continue plus the technical corrections, excluding debt service, has our expenditures right now at about $378.8 million. And the maximum allowed to qualify for ERIP is $380.4 million. So right now, with just the request and the technical adjustments, we are within the expenditure levels to qualify for the state aid payment. Again, if you go back to the June 23rd presentation, when we presented at that point, we originally projected expenditures to be higher than the maximum level. And we're within the limit right now, primarily because of the technical adjustments to health and benefit rate increases. When we consider any supplemental requests, the executive and adopted budgets would have to remain below the ERIP target in order for us to maintain state aid. Okay, so I'm going to switch gears a little bit, talk more generally about timeline and process, and then we'll open it up for questions and discussion. Our official legislative process for the budget is starting very soon. The capital budget will be introduced at the next Common Council meeting on September 2nd. After the introduction, Finance Committee will have 2 days of briefings from agencies where they present the budget to the Finance Committee. The committee will have a week to propose any amendments to the budget. And then amendments will be due on September 24th. And we'll publish them on Friday, September 26th for consideration at the Finance Committee meeting of September 29th. On the operating budget side, the operating executive budget will be introduced on October 7th. The Finance Committee briefings will be on this October 13th and 14th, followed by an amendment week, and amendments will be considered at the meeting on October 27th. After the Finance Committee considers both budgets, both budgets will be referred back to the full council for consideration. You'll have about a week and a half to propose amendments. All Common Council amendments will be due November 5th, published on November 6th, and there will be up to 3 meetings beginning on November 11th for the adoption of the 26 budget. The capital budget briefings will be at the next Finance Committee meeting, so beginning September 8th. Agencies will present highlights of their capital budget, including major changes from the prior year, followed by questions from alders. And then after we go through the briefings, you can submit your amendment ideas to myself and the budget analyst team. All of the budget materials will be available on September 2nd at our budget webpage. You can cityofmadison.com/budget, and I have a slightly more direct link here. And I have a draft schedule of the presentations. So on September 8th, we'll do Library Monona Terrace, PCED, Public Safety and Transportation. And on September 9th, we'll have the administration agencies, Public Works and Engineering present. I just have a few pointers about how to prepare for capital hearings. The budget book right now, we're finalizing the draft. It's well over 200 pages, so there's a lot to read and not a little time. A few things that you might want to look at. We did an overview of the capital agency requests at the May 27th meeting. So you can find a summary presentation of major items in the requests, as well as watch your recording. When we publish the budget, we'll have an executive summary that summarizes the big picture approach on the budget, as well as highlighting major projects and initiatives. It's a separate document, but it's on our budget webpage. And I think that's, I always recommend people start with a summary before diving into the actual document. We also have usually like a 4 to 6 page budget introduction. We have a summary of our budget policies, guidelines, and a 1 page like how to read an agency budget. And then it explains each section. So I always recommend that as well. And if you want to get into the details, each of the agency budgets will have the detailed funding source and timeline for all of their projects and programs. We're a few weeks out from amendments, but I did want to cover just the general basics of amendments. I know that there are a lot of new alders, and so we can review this again as we get closer, but wanted to provide this as a primer. So amendments are really the opportunity for alders to provide any proposed changes to projects. So this could be an opportunity where you want to increase, decrease, change the timeline, or make another kind of programmatic change to something that's proposed in the executive budget. In terms of who can submit an amendment, any alder can submit an idea. A finance committee member, a finance committee member can submit an amendment during finance committee or common council, and a non-finance committee member can request an amendment at finance committee if they have a finance committee sponsor. So this can be council leadership who are on the committee, or it can be another finance committee member. But non-finance committee members can also wait until the full council meets in November. I know that it can be intimidating to draft an amendment. You don't need to have a fully fledged plan when you start, but we do ask that you reach out with to the budget team and to staff who are impacted by your idea, to at least you should at least know what agency you're trying to amend the budget for, what program or project you're trying to amend the project for, and a brief description of what you're trying to accomplish. And staff can help you develop that kind of outline into a more fully fledged idea. But you should at least know agency, project, and what you're trying to accomplish. And again, in terms of deadlines, I have that on the full table slide. But for Finance Committee Capital, the deadline is to reach out to us by Wednesday, September 24th. Finance Committee Operating, Wednesday, October 22nd. And for the full Common Council amendments, Wednesday, November 5th. And we ask that you reach out to us by noon on each of those Wednesdays. Again, you don't need a fully fledged amendment written out, but we do need to know that you are working on something so that we are ready to turn that around and publish it on the following Friday. And finally, where and how does this all happen? This will all be online through emails or phone calls. You can submit, you as alders can submit your ideas to myself or the budget analyst via email, or you can call us to discuss your proposals. We will work with you on completing the fiscal analysis of the requests. We usually share drafts back and forth to make sure that the narrative matches your intent. We generally ask if you're working with multiple alders on an amendment that you all are copied on the emails and drafts, so that to minimize some of the back and forth to confirm who's sponsoring what versions, and we'll try to help streamline all of this as well. And then the amendments are taken up at the Finance Committee meetings at the end of September and October. And we'll have regular business at the start of the meeting, and then we'll vote on amendments, typically taken in order of how they're presented in the packet. One thing I want to emphasize is that it's very important to engage agency staff if you're trying to amend their budget. Again, an amendment can include adding funding, creating a new project, reallocating or shifting funding around. Many agencies already have strategic plans and work plans that lay out what they're planning to do for the next 1 to 5 years. So it's really important to understand how your idea interacts with existing agency work plans. So some questions to consider is, how is this project change relate? How does it interact with existing plans? Is the project already on the horizon list? Does the agency have the capacity to implement a project if you're trying to move it forward in the timeline? And are there any operating budget impacts to capital amendments? We recommend it's never too early to start reaching out to staff to talk about these ideas. So you can review the request now. And if you know you're going to work on something, reach out sooner than later. And then finally, when you finalize and submit your amendment, we really just ask that you are kind of taking in all of the considerations that you learned from your staff engagements as you're working with us to create a final draft. So again, process tips, engage agency staff. I covered that on the last slide. Engage budget staff. So please don't hesitate to reach out to me or any of the budget analysts as you are working through your ideas. And we do have the analyst staff assignments available on EmployeeNet. You can always reach out to me directly as well. And you can start reaching out to us at any point in time after the budget is introduced. And you can start reaching out to us to talk about ideas even before the Finance Committee briefings. And again, as a reminder, any alder can submit a Finance Committee amendment. If you are not on the committee, you must have a Finance Committee sponsor. Common Council amendments must have two sponsors. And when the budget goes to Common Council, the Common Council will consider the budget as amended by Finance. So the Common Council won't go back to deliberate on anything passed by Finance Committee. So if an alder wants to change an outcome of a Finance Committee amendment, they'll have to propose another amendment during Common Council. And we just ask that co-sponsors are included on emails to quickly confirm that everyone's on the same page with the same version of a file. So that is all I had, and welcome any questions.
Thank you, Christine. Before we go to questions, I'm going to hand the chair over to President Bitiver to chair the rest of the meeting as I make my way back to Madison. So thank you, President Bitiver, and I bid you all a good evening.
Thank you, Mayor. Alder Figueroa-Cole.
Thank you. Thank you, Christine, Finance, for all these very helpful process presentations. So I have a few questions, and I guess I'm gonna start with the very beginning of the presentation when you had this slide about revenue and expenses. On that slide that you had the expenses detail. Let me look it up, what the number was. I don't remember. It says that has a revenue of $450.1 million. Does that include the state aid money, the $7 million of Arab states amount?
Yes, it does.
Okay, thank you. And then when it comes to the discussion about how to read the agency asks, for the most part, is that accurate to say that for the most part, the cost to continue and the 2026 request are usually the same dollar amount? Except, I mean, I think I understood that the cost of continue and the are numbers that are calculated by Finance, but then the last column reflects changes to adjustments to moving money from one place to the other. So the final dollar amount, I will imagine, will still kind of be close to the cost to continue. Is that accurate?
Yes, for the general fund agencies, the cost to continue total was the agency's target or their budget. I think with one exception, everyone was within that target. You might see some movement across lines. So someone might reduce purchase services to increase supplies, but that total should be the same. And then enterprises could have increased expenses if they had the revenue to support it. So that's another area where you might see a bigger difference between cost to continue and request.
Thank you. And so then for the items that the asks that were not, that didn't complete the form for a supplemental, how are those treated on the budget process? Are they prioritized? Are those ignored? Are those places that elders go and look for amendments? What happens to the other requests that were not in your summary because they didn't fill the form?
That's a great question. One of the process steps that wasn't included here was that we do have internal deliberations and briefings with agencies and staff and mayor's staff and finance on the budget. So there has been some discussion about things that were not formally in the request because it might not have met the parameters of the supplemental. So there has been some discussion, and I think there's still we're still working on developing the executive budget. So that will be presented when we release the executive in October.
Is there a list of all those questions, of all of those, or do we have to actually just look at all of them one by one?
The only ones in general fund agencies were in fire and OIM, and then within the enterprises, there were various adjustments that people made based on projected rates and revenues. I don't think I have a comprehensive list of all of those changes. Most of those were more technical in nature in terms of increasing expenses, but they're not. I think the agency memo is where department heads were directed to highlight any of those changes.
Thank you.
Other questions for staff? Alder Matthews.
This might be a silly question, but I was wanting to ask because you had mentioned that sometimes a reason for something to go on the supplemental requests is if like a grant is ending. So I'm just wondering why the COPS amount wasn't part of the supplemental requests, but was instead part of that section that was for, you know, things that were just getting adjusted in the main request.
Thanks for that question. I think this is something that we discussed internally and with the police department. And when that COPS grant was first included in the budget a few years ago, there was pretty robust discussion about it and acknowledgement of the increasing general fund portion and that the officers would be full-time staff on the city levy at the end of the grant period. And there were several related resolutions to accepting the grant that included this kind of phased levy funding. And because it was part of the discussions and acceptance of the grant that it would eventually be fully levy funded, we felt like that was more of a cost to continue adjustment.
Thank you. That makes sense. I just, you know, was curious.
Yeah, absolutely.
Other questions for staff? Seeing none, I'm going to take the chair's prerogative and ask a couple of my own. So you mentioned revenue adjustments for libraries. I'm just wondering if that was the result of federal cuts that we're seeing to libraries and museums?
I believe this was all related to various partnership agreements and payments received and going out between the Dane County and South Central Library System.
And
then my second question was the fleet rates changing. Again, looking at whether that was the result of loss of federal electric vehicle benefits or anything of that nature.
No, so that federal funding would have shown up in the capital budget. In the operating budget, that's primarily related to higher costs for maintenance and other related expenses.
Thank you so much. All right, since this is a discussion item, I think that if there are no other questions, that we are able to move on to item 16.
Item 16 was just a discussion about the meeting format for budget deliberations. In the past few years, we've had both fully virtual meetings and also we've had hybrid for the meetings where the Finance Committee votes on final amendments. So that would be on September 29th and October 27th. So it was, we wanted to bring it to the committee and have you all decide how you want to proceed, whether it's hybrid or fully virtual for those days.
Mulder Evers.
Yeah, I think this keeping them hybrid are fine. I mean, some of us, if we're in town, will certainly want to be there in person. I think whenever we can be in person, it's a good idea. But if someone is out of town but still able to make the meeting, I think we ought to create that opportunity. Thanks.
Any other thoughts? And I just to clarify, I don't think that there was ever a suggestion of making anything fully in person, that it would either be fully online or hybrid. That's my impression. So any other comments as to the preferences of the body for those meetings? Go ahead, Alder Figueroa Cole.
Yeah, I mean, if it's a choice between the two, I will second a hybrid meeting.
All right, so I think you have your answer. Sounds like we have at least two saying, let's do hybrid, and nobody else saying no to that. So I think that we can do hybrid, but we're doing just online for the presentations. Is that correct?
Yeah, we've typically done the briefings virtual and then amendments hybrid, or if something was hybrid, that just that meeting.
Great. Excellent. All right. I believe that brings us to the end of the agenda, so I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
If seeing no discussion or concerns, then we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone, and see you soon.